it's time now for Oh the Humanities, taking a look at humanities scholarship, research, and events on and around campus. And we are joined, as always, by Max Orr, who heads up Carolina Public Humanities at UNC. Humanities.unc.edu is the website. Max, good to have you here.
It's wonderful to be here, Aaron, off from vacation. Last night, I tried very hard to tap in that last ball in the Duke-UCF game, but they couldn't call on me. They called too late.
If you tried to tap it in, that might have been why I rimmed out. You never know. Yeah, this is what happens when you avoid tempting fate and try to do things yourself.
So it's interesting. As I just mentioned to you, I was in Mexico on my way back. I was really surprised. Of course, all the planes were coming to North Carolina, so I shouldn't have been that surprised. But the amount of Carolina blue, I did not see a drop of Duke blue on any of the planes or anywhere in Mexico where we landed. So I feel like we're in good shape in terms of international support.
Yeah.
So listen, speaking of international support, I want to introduce my guest, but by doing that, I'm going to bring up one thing related to today's date. Today is March 25th. Mm-hmm. And I know you are celebrating the birthday of Vasily III, the Russian Tsar, born in 1479 on March 25th. And what I loved about him, I was speaking with our guest, and we both are sort of trying to place Vasily. He's in between Ivan the Great and Ivan the Terrible. Which one comes first, the Great or the Terrible?
The Great.
The Great.
Yeah. So this is Vasily the Fine, then?
No, actually, it's funny. Oh, His name was Vasily the Adequate.
Oh, I was right. So, man.
Yes, exactly. So this is a great introduction for our guest is Graham Robertson. He is the professor of political science and our resident expert on modern Russia and modern Russian politics. And of course, Vasily the Adequate is a Russian ruler. And Dr. Robertson's new book is Putin versus the People, The Perilous Politics of Divided Russia. And it's coming up on June 11th. So we thought, this is a great way of talking about Russian leadership, and boy, it's in the news a little bit lately.
This is a vaguely timely issue. Yes. Dr. Robertson, thanks for being here.
Welcome. Thank you for inviting me. I hope to also be adequate.
Awesome. So tell us about the book. What is, I usually ask what's the inspiration, but mm-hmm. the daily headlines, I suppose, would have something to do with it. Tell us about the project.
So the inspiration really comes from frustration with the way Russia's talked about in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's talked about a lot. And this book is an attempt to reach out beyond the academy, beyond a kind of scholarly audience into the wider public sphere, and to try and change the conversation. And essentially, there's two ways that we talk about Russian politics. We either talk about Russia as being, I kind of think of this as Putin, the super villain kind of.
Right.
There's nothing in the world that goes wrong without his hand being behind
it.
He's a brilliant manipulator of our minds and all of that stuff. And it really doesn't take very long to look at life in Russia to realize that if he was a super genius, things would be better.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other way we think about it is of Russians themselves as being kind of, anti-democratic. They've always been, there was serfdom and there was Vasily the Adequate, and it's all kind
good
of
good enough for the
long,
Russians.
Yeah,
continuous,
yeah.
Kind of trudge through autocracy ever since. And of course, that's completely erroneous too. It's an old idea actually in American politics, and one of the fun things in the book is we tell some stories about diaper politics in the early Cold War era.
Mm-hmm.
And draw a line to a connection with that story.
Well, what's diaper politics?
Yeah.
So this was the idea that Russians essentially, Russians swaddle their babies. Mm-hmm. Russians and lots of other peoples around the world swaddle their babies, and so there was Margaret Mead headed up a big research team that was essentially funded by the American military at the end of the Second World War, and the project was to find out how to handle the Russians after the war was over.
Okay.
And so they hit upon this idea of swaddling as being sort of central to the Russian psyche, that there was a Russian psyche, not multiple Russian psyches,
right.
And the Russian leadership would behave the way Russians do, even though the leader was actually Georgian. Right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. details. Right? And so where it was...
It's all the same once you get over to Central Asia.
Different alphabets.
And the thing about swaddling is, you're kind of like bound in by these wraps. And so the babies grow up to be convinced that there's this constraining force on the outside that just kind of... that they can't struggle against in any meaningful way, and they just give up, essentially.
Oh, wow.
And so they have this kind of catastrophic sort of... Things are either going to be a total disaster, or we're just going to like hold on here and hold tight and it's all going to be fine. So how Russians think.
That was the idea, right?
Yeah. Is the opposite of that diaper politics where you can just let it fly and someone else will clean up your mess?
Yeah.
It's American politics.
That's called free range politics. Yeah.
And so this was an idea which, you know, was really popular with the military because it wanted to justify it, vast expenditure in the Cold War.
Well, that's an important thing just with the way that we tell stories about the world around us. We have a tendency to come up with stories that justify what we already think or what we want to do, right?
Right, yeah.
All right.
So I'm curious about the Putin versus the people. Is this a sense that it's Putin's actions against the people or the people reacting to Putin? What are you seeing that would, that's a pretty bold title. What are you seeing in this relationship between the people and Putin that would put it in such antagonistic terms?
Yeah, so the idea really is that the politics is like in lots of other places, it's highly contested. And that the strong support that you see in lots of the survey work and you see in the elections for President Putin is there because they work really hard to create it, and they work really hard to create it in lots of different ways that we talk about in the book. The most obvious way is through control of the media and really relentless and exhausting propaganda and terrible music, variety show performance type music that's very prevalent on the state TV channels, but also through lots of other ways, through active coordination on social media. So there's a group of people called the Defenders, whose job it is to basically handle the narrative on social media, and we were able to hackers are great. So there's a hacking group in Russia called Humpty Dumpty. And Humpty Dumpty broke into the Kremlin intranet and stole a bunch of emails. And you read these emails, and what you see is you get correspondence between the head of Putin's domestic politics unit, his staff, and then these defenders are in the country, whose job it is to kind of try and shape the agenda. And so you see this performance backwards and forwards, where the Kremlin says, let's not talk about the devaluation of the currency because that's a bummer, right? And then the people, the mid-level bureaucrats are like, but that's all anyone's ever talking about, and we can't get our message out. And if you guys don't stop screwing up at the top, then how are we supposed to get our message out down here? And so there's this really bad, fantastically interesting interaction between politics on the ground in the trenches, if you like. And in this case, in Ukraine, it was, in eastern Ukraine, it was literally in the trenches. Mm-hmm. And politics at the Kremlin and the Kremlin's attempts to shape the narrative. So that's one way in which it happens. But other ways in which the support for Putin is kind of created is through the uncoordinated actions of citizens, either in institutions like the church or very prominently in the schools. So patriotic education is something that's conducted in the schools very vigorously. That's really actually not centrally coordinated. There's the Ministry of Education is not very good at producing kind of pamphlets and methodologies for teaching patriotic education, but the school teachers have been doing it since the Soviet period, and so they are good at it. And so there's this kind of bottom up sort of effort to create the sense of an equation between Russian patriotism and support for the president, to create this idea that it's normal, it's expected, and if you're not a supporter of the president, then you're somehow deviant.
Interesting.
So that's part of the story.
So does that suggest that there's kind of a widespread artificiality to support for Putin, that it's kind of generated, but there is a lot of support for Putin that comes out of the generation. Right?
Exactly. And the support, it's real, right? In the sense that people, based on the information that they have and in the context that they exist it's natural and it makes sense, and they'll defend the regime with you. There are to be perfectly fair, lots of people, conservative oriented Russians, who actually support Putin's policies, actually support the values that the regime has been putting forward. The regime for the first sort of decade or so was very much a kind of free market neoliberal kind of regime, and the economy was booming, and so that was all fine. And then when after the financial crisis of 2008-2009, they sort of switched their story to being one about patriotism, about conservatism, about orthodoxy, which they had really not touched before. And so sharing those values became one of the foundations of the regime. But the truth is that most people go along with it because it's what everybody else is doing.
Right,
so we did
right.
research on personality politics and looking at different personality traits. And the best predictor of being a regime supporter, of adopting their values, is being someone who really values social harmony, who values getting along with others. And it's not really about being a conservative. It's just about, you know, leaving me alone. And so that makes you strong, but it also makes you vulnerable. So once the conversation changes for some reason, once the narrative changes, then those people who are just doing it to get along will switch.
Interesting.
So that it seems like there's all of these efforts with these influencers online and, you know, doing all this. Is there a natural, if they weren't doing this, you had just sort of hinted at this, is there a natural groundswell of protests that would come out if it weren't being constantly in the schools through propaganda or through these influencers on social media? Do you have a sense that there is some sort of, you know, formed opposition around certain ideas that could, in fact, emerge and become influential in social media and whatnot if it weren't for the efforts of the state to keep a handle on that?
Yeah, so there is a very clear team of people and community of people around a name that you may have probably have heard of, Alexei Navalny, who is the, I would say far and away now, the most kind of dominant figure in the Russian opposition. He has support of maybe somewhere in the region of 10-15% of the population. If there was open elections, if there was open media, that would go up considerably. How far it would go up, you know, one would see. But he's really focused around anti-corruption efforts, which is a really popular message. People recognize there is corruption everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's a very serious problem. The claim of the regime to kind of economic competence that it used to run on is very, very thin. You know, they've had not just essentially a decade of economic stagnation since 2008, but they've also repeatedly reformed the pension scheme with the result of basically confiscating people's pensions. Twice, not once, but twice.
So austerity politics.
Yeah. So there's a real there's not a sort of you know, if everything was free, this would be the level of percent of support, right? That's impossible to say. But if everything was more open, there would be, you know, it's very clear that there could be a big change in the landscape.
Speaking with Graham Robertson and Max Org and humanities.unc.edu for more information on Carolina Public Humanities. All that you're describing, Dr. Robertson, in terms of democracy in Russia and democratic discourse and the manipulation of it, has got to be constantly in flux and changing and evolving and growing. How do you see it developing down the road? What are the trends that you're seeing?
Right. So this is people always say to me all the time, oh, it must be really interesting to study Russia right now. And the truth is, it's always really interesting.
Yeah.
It's always in flux.
It's the time when everyone says, oh, it must be really interesting. That's the most boring time. It's all of the like quiet times that it's really gets exciting.
So there's it's always in flux. I've been studying opposition and street politics in Russia for a couple of decades now.
What got you into that?
So I got into studying Russia through the Cold War. Essentially, I grew up next to a U.S. nuclear submarine base in Scotland, and we were, you know, it was the 1980s. We were all going to get killed in a nuclear war, and you know, we were told we were number four on the Soviets list. And so I was kind of curious as to why I wasn't going to get out of my teenage years.
Did you find out why you were never number three?
If they'd known you were there,
they would have gone ahead. And so I've just been interested in Russia ever since. And then I got interested in protest and street politics because when I came to the US to study Russia, everyone was studying privatization. Everyone was studying the creation of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a little bit of a Marxist and I was like, well, capitalism's obviously going to, you know, it's going to have its downside, right? So the next wave of study is going to be people complaining about the way the economy is working and the market's working. And they're going to notice that they've had all their stuff stolen. And so this is going to be exciting. And, you know, they sort of did. They didn't notice it in as big numbers as I was hoping, but that's where I got into that.
Interesting. So I interrupted you about the trends going forward.
Right. So there's been this very big, very big is you know, it's all relative to the size of the country. But there've been substantial anti-corruption protests in the last year or two. And one of the things that people like me have noticed with that is that there is a very big youth presence in those events. And so one of the things that we're looking at now is seeing how youth evolve. And people typically have thought of young people as being big supporters of President Putin, big supporters of nationalism. So losing that constituency would be a really problematic. And so we're following that. We're also following very closely the extent to which people start to attach blame for corruption to the president himself. There have been, one of the things that Alexei Navalny does is he does these incredibly interesting investigations into elite corruption. And a video that pins vast corruption on Dmitry Medvedev, who's the prime minister who used to be president for a little while.
The adequate.
Dmitry the adequate. That's at over 100 million views in Russia. And so, to the extent to which those ideas start to catch on, then the social acceptability of Putin will start to disintegrate and things will fall apart.
You know, it's interesting that in an age where we're seeing a lot of populist movements around in Europe and, of course, in the United States and Brexit, et cetera, Gilets Jaunes movement in France, do you see, it's interesting because a lot of those are associated with sort of right-wing agitation from Russia even. There's been that accusation that that's part of the propaganda. Is there a populist movement in Russia that would react to the elites? Because it's the same idea. You know, the elites are out of touch, they're corrupt, the quality of life hasn't gotten any better with the system. That's how populism emerges. Do you see that a possibility?
That's really interesting. That's basically been the competition in Russia over the last few years has been over ownership of populism. So Putin's trying to own populism. Like he's the person fighting for the common man. And if you watch, you know, he gives these long rambling addresses.
This is all sounding real familiar.
Yeah. Does it sound familiar? Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that this book is co-authored with a friend of mine, Sam Green, who's at King's College in London. And we often talk about this parallels between, you know, American politics and he's in London, so British politics, and Russia, and you know, lots of the things are the same. The big difference is that in Russia, the sort of the echo chamber, that claims populism is not 50% of the electorate or 30% of the electorate, but it's about 70% of the electorate. Right? So, this sort of patriotic majority is a majority there, and so there's big competition between Putin on the one hand and Navalny on the other to claim this kind of mantle of being, you know, I represent the people, right? Navalny has been heavily criticized in the West for, you know, frankly downright racist statements about the North Caucasus within the southern part of Russia and about Chechnya, which were seen as his attempt to kind of claim that sort of nationalist populist mantle. I think it was probably more down to the fact he hadn't spent a lot of time in the West and he didn't realize it was not cool to talk that way. Now that he realizes it's not cool, he's stopping it. But there is this big competition over that. And that's the ground that politics, unfortunately, is being played upon there and here and lots of other places.
So you got to wrap up the conversation again. The book is called Putin Versus the People, right? Graham Robertson, the author. Max,
next Tuesday, April 2nd, you can come and hear Graham Robertson at Flyleaf Books as part of our Humanities in Action series. It happens every Tuesday. Tomorrow, of course, we have a wonderful talk as well on Puerto Rico after the terrible hurricane. Mm-hmm. So take a look at humanities.unc.edu for Humanities in Action. But April 2nd, next Tuesday at 4:30
at Flyleaf Books.
Opportunity.
Awesome. Again, humanities.unc.edu is the website for information on that event and plenty of others. Max Orr, Graham Robertson, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks
for having me.